Mr. Cardinal, what do you remember about Duncan Bradford?
Well, I remember primarily how amazed and flabbergasted people were, scientists and others, at Bradford's background knowledge, the amount of reading. Most of us had never read anything like that unless it was assigned to us. And but Bradford's background was so entirely different that he had read and analyzed and diagnosed things out of the books. And so when he went out west, people were just amazed because most people had not read anything like that or even attempted to diagnose it. And I think that was all the way along was the people's impressions, scientists and farmers, that the amount of background material that F.C. Bradford had released.
Mm-hmm. Stored in his head to begin with.
Yeah. And I don't remember any of the early time scientists and agriculturists, horticulturists, and so forth, that had even approached the things that Bradford had read and had analyzed and talked about. So I think that was the main impression that everybody had that had known anything about Bradford.
Now, did he teach, or was he doing just research?
Well, the main things he was remembered by was his research, of course. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his research was carrying the knowledge that he had acquired, mm-hmm, from reading and experience. So I think that's what made people accept Bradford, because I can't think of any of them, V.R. Gardner included, who had any background knowledge of what Bradford had acquired. And so they were very much impressed with him. And when I worked on the material that's in that publication, I guess the only one that'll be remembered around Michigan maybe, is that publication there where we worked on the things that Bradford had almost taught us. Mm-hmm. And those are the things I remember. That publication was, they asked me to pile everything I could get rid of in the museum over here. And that, I wanted a copy of that book, and it was one of them that went into the museum. I don't know what they'll ever do with it, but it'll be piled up with the other.
Now, what were your responsibilities? I shouldn't say responsibilities, that sounds as if you were a subordinate, but what was your work involved in this? I suppose you went back through the records and checked temperatures and,
yes,
reports.
And the basis of that publication, which I've almost forgotten already, was the basic things involved in a tree and its growth. And as I say, I'd have to reread it and almost to talk about it and tell why it was so welcome and so impressive to so many scientists around the country and maybe outside of the country, which was a surprise to all of us.
I think it's the documentation that you did go through 80 winters and look at the data.
That's right. And I wouldn't be surprised that Bradford inspired us to do that sort of thing and from his background and teaching.
Now, what was his contribution to the bulletin?
Mostly guidance and analysis, I think. He'd see what we were working on and what we'd found out, and then he could diagnose it and analyze it better than any of us had been working on, because we didn't have the basic background that he had acquired.
He took the data that you were digging out and put it together.
That's right.
Evaluate it.
And helped us get it down and not lose it.
Now, when you say us, who else was involved?
I can't even answer that, I guess, because I can't remember who all.
You and Fred.
Go ahead.
You and Fred were the only ones.
Well, we were the only ones.
Mr. Carnell was traveling. Mr. Bradford was here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the difference in the.
Yeah, you were extension pomologist.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And of course, Gardner said, now, you've got to stay home some. I've traveled county by county by county in Michigan. And I'd be gone. They finally ended up by saying, now the rule is you're to be out in the state traveling to the counties. Three weeks out of each month. And then we were back in East Lansing 1 week, the last week of the month.
And then when you got back, he said, when are you going out again?
Yes. Yeah, that was a standard question that V.R. Gardner would say, well, where have you been this month? Well, I'd give him a rough draft on it. And he'd say, well, when are you going out again? He hardly gave us the idea that we were supposed to be in 1 month, 1 week out of each month. But we didn't do much when we were in here except talk and plan on getting out again.
Now, to go back to Bradford before leaving him, what kind of a man was he personally?
Well, he was very friendly and very kindly. And of course, impressed everybody with his knowledge and his background.
Very much a man's man, though.
And his ability to diagnose and analyze for us, far beyond what any of us, from the head of the department on down through the experiment station, they couldn't even begin to approach him.
As far as taking a mass of information and pulling out conclusions from it, analyzing data and
yes,
past the literature.
And guiding and then inspiring us to work on it some more, go after this.
Pointing out the things that were important to.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Because of his background.
Now, what does it mean that he was a man's man, Mrs. Cardinal?
Mr. Cardinal says he was very friendly, not social, though, and not very tidy. And you're particularly interested. In just general social things.
He was wrapped up in his work.
Definitely. That's why I got so much reading done.
So he wasn't a man for small talk or social.
No, not very much. It was a waste of time for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the time we wanted to waste.
Did he do much traveling in the state himself, or did he?
Very, very little.
Close to home?
Very little.
And did growers know him?
Hardly any of them. Except, as others pointed out, what he had done and how he had analyzed it and contributed toward it. But directly, I don't think half a dozen of them ever laid eyes on him.
Yes, it would be Farmers Week. That was quite important at that time.
Yes, those are top fruit and vegetable growers, florists, came down here for Farmers Week, and then the institution had drawn in all the high talent they could afford and could commandeer. But other than that, most of them didn't know him except by name.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because he didn't go out and didn't attend other meetings, unless he was induced to do so.
Now, how much of that did Gardner do? Did he tend to stay pretty close to East Lansing?
Yes, he did, because there weren't funds to travel by for one thing, and they never thought that the head of the department should be going out doing anything practical. And so they said, well, these other fellows that have travel and know the state, they'll do it for us. So we would pump these men from and read their technical stuff even. Even though we had to go to them and ask them to interpret what we were trying to read there. That was far more a situation in those days than it would be today, of course.
Now, what was a typical week in an extension man's life then? Did you, I suppose you stayed out most of the week. You didn't get back to East Lansing.
Oh, no, no. We stayed out the entire time. And hard to recall what we did.
Did you go as far as Traverse City?
Oh, Upper Peninsula, and they stayed 3 weeks out there.
Yes, and they said, now when you go to the UP, the Upper Peninsula, don't think you can come back here just to see your family.
Can I tell my story?
Catch up on your work.
I think you can tell your story, sure.
Well, we didn't use long distance then, you know. We didn't really, any of us, have much money. So after Mr. Carnell retired, he was, I think it was with Art Mitchell, he went with one of the men. And they telephoned to the office that they wouldn't be home for dinner. And I said to Ms. Barrett, well, that certainly is a relief. I didn't know whether you'd be home within 3 or 4 days, you know. I said, it was a great relief.
Now, those were rugged days, rugged months.
How did you travel, let's say, in the 30s?
Well, mostly by our own car, I guess.
Model T's, and not Model T's in the 30s, but...
But the first traveling was all done by train.
Of course. We went, used the train.
It was the 20s, though.
1923, 1924.
And it was a long time before there was such a thing as a bus.
I don't think you took buses much.
We heard of omnibuses, but...
But you didn't have to go by stage anywhere.
No, no. We had outlived that period. Mm-hmm. But most all of it was by train, and I suppose that where the train went was where we could go. Mm-hmm.
So how would you get to the Upper Peninsula?
That practically determined it. Well, see, that was before the bridge was built, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, long before the bridge was built. So we had to get up to the edge of the lake. Or
to the straits.
And then the problem was to hang around until there was a ferry going across. We all crossed by ferry, of course. Mm-hmm. And that took a long time. Sometimes we'd stay down there for days, edge, waiting for the ferry to get enough transportation.
I mean, waiting for them to get enough customers to make it worth their time?
Well, it wasn't much customer. It was
just freight. Getting the ferry there.
It was storage. It was whatever they had to ship across. And so waiting for that ferry was a task we never forgot. But we didn't know anything else, of course. Couldn't swim across, couldn't get a boat, a small boat or anything of that sort that was going across.
I think when you got there, you relied on the county agent very largely for transportation, as I remember.
No, that was true.
As far as getting around to farms in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yes. County agents had provided, as they do today, I guess, pretty largely.
Now, what about wintertime? Did you have problems with trains?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, we sometimes would be held down for days before I could go anywhere.
Well, you had a most interesting time up there by... wasn't it Hart and Shelby up in that section? The trains didn't run. They had to, and they had no food. They had to walk. And the snow was as high as the fences and over to a house. And the woman had a sick baby, but she had fresh bread.
They were stuck on the train. Mm-hmm. They had to get off the train, mm-hmm. walk through the fields to the house.
Uh-huh. And because I remember Mr. Carmel sent medicine for the baby after he got home.
Yeah, she had a sick baby. And
But you had a meeting up there, even in spite of that, though.
Many of them.
They must have come in sleighs, I guess, because you had a meeting on that trip where you were snowbound.
Well, how about South Haven? I presume that you had a lot of contact with Stanley Johnston down there.
Oh, yes, of course, because we have the experiment station there.
Mm-hmm.
And the top-notch fruit growers, vegetables and so forth, horticulturists, they were very much impressed with what they'd heard about that station. Very few of them had ever been there, of course. And so we tried to pick up the information and peddle it out in meetings. Otherwise, they would never know about it for years.
Stanley's father was a county agent, too, when Mr. Cardinale first came here.
That's right. Almost forgotten that.
And you worked with him, you worked with both Johnstons then?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
His father and Stanley.
Yeah. But of course, Stanley was so much better known in later years than anyone else around, but that we translated him, I guess, carried out his findings.
You'd be setting up meetings and he would be the primary speaker in some cases, or one of the...
Yes. Only locally, though.
Yeah.
He almost never left the place. And, of course, very few people had ever been down there.
Well, you had your own experiments down
there,
too.
They knew about it, but we carried out and ran experiments in various places. And what's our famous fellow that I worked with so long up there at Penville?
You mean Oliver Roth?
No, he died here not so long ago.
He was on the staff, or was he a grower?
Oh, yes, Trevor Nichols.
Trevor Nichols.
Mm-hmm. Trevor Nichols.
Yeah.
He was a grower.
He was a grower at Finville.
Yeah.
But he was a highly trained man, basically.
And he was a Chicago newspaper man before he came to the farm.
So after I knew him, got acquainted, and he liked my approach, we did an awful lot of comparative work at his place and used his brain to help us analyze it and get references and so forth.
Do you know the story about Trevor Nichols?
No.
Well, he raised some particular kind of cattle. Don't ask me what kind. And was awarded the grand prize or something. He wouldn't take it. He said, well, I'm a horticulturist. I just grow these things on the side. He wouldn't take their award.
So I just registered cattle for income.
Because the orchard wouldn't pay.
Now, the farm at Finville, which now belongs to the university, is called the Trevor Nichols Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume you must have left it to the university.
Yes.
That's right, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they hesitate about taking it?
Oh, they had an awful time.
They were getting too much land, I think, was the trouble, though.
Hardly anybody wanted to.
But he wanted them to have it.
Mm-hmm. Gardner helped push us, get it accepted, I guess, in ways. And still talks about it and writes about it in Florida.
Now, what kinds of experiments did you do there at Finville?
Well, that publication was the basic one. That was one that was interesting to me, and I'd have to glance it over to get some of the points there.
I was thinking of at Finville, particularly, at Trevor Nichols.
Trevor Nichols, he called himself. And
you spoke about cooperative research with him and the fact that he was interested in analyzing the data, too.
Yeah, well, his basic knowledge impressed some of us very much. So I almost camped on his place to get him to carry these out.
Mm-hmm.
If you turn that off, I'll tell you another good story.
Are you sure you can't tell it without...
I don't think it'd be a good idea.
I'd like to hear what your memories of Gardner are.
Well, basically, he had an unusual training and background. And a lot of it was from his reading, which most early day professors didn't do that much reading. But he had access to it and had read a lot of those things, which we heard about later. But part of that, of course, put him in a bad light because of his frankness, I think.
And he turned people off a little because he was so frank?
Yes. And I say, in general, many people didn't like him personally because of those characteristics and his expression of his thoughts. So that's, I think, made him very well thought of in some categories and not well thought of by others. And I think
that's... But he was very good about encouraging men to do what they had would like to work on.
Yes, and he almost talked you into it, as well as encouraging. And he really forced you into it. You had to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And that was true when the first time I went to Brazil was at his inspiration. And later on in the Second World War, when they wanted most all the agricultural institutions, at least, to release men and women in various fields of work to go to these various countries, because many of these countries were begging for help, that those who wanted to go were family men mainly, who had young children.
You told that.
Well, it wasn't on here, was it?
I don't remember now. Well, go ahead.
And so they didn't want to go if they had small children who would go into a foreign country and hear mainly a foreign language. And we had the same experience. I went to Brazil and had learned to speak Portuguese and to understand it quite well before I learned to read it or could find a teacher to teach us what we were hearing. And when I did that, it inspired me quite a little to go ahead with it, that there was some reason for it. And it was useful. And so we found a French woman who spoke and read French fluently, but had mastered Portuguese. So we had finally, after learning to speak it for a year or more, we learned to read it and to understand what we were reading.
I think he's sending you in charge of the Japanese was the best thing.
Oh, yes.
We maintained it was because Mr. Cardinal was on this, you know, his uncle's ranch. They had a Japanese foreman. So he was supposed to be able to handle all the Japanese during the World War II.
Yes.
Resettlement?
During the Second World War, they were just begging for people to work with men who had gone to other country or had come from other countries. And so Mr. Gardner knew that at Hood River, Oregon, where I spent much of my first 25 years, that our only labor was Japanese labor. And most of them couldn't read or write or understand English. And so Professor Gardner said, well, Carnell. You worked with the Japanese laborers up there. Why don't you take over this program and see if we can't give the U.S. government some help in getting people to go out to other countries, and especially in your case, to Brazil, where you spent some time. And
it was the program here first, though.
But these Japanese people were moved away out of California, out of the West Coast, weren't they?
Yes.
It was two fruit growers who came, and they were going down to Arkansas. That was one of the camps. Mm-hmm. And they wanted somebody from the Hurt Department to go with them. So Mr. Cardinale and our son went with them.
And because of their knowledge of Japanese.
The funnier part was Mr. Cardinale was dictating and saw one of the men in Hurt at the door, you know, through that glass. Mm-hmm. So when he came in, he began speaking this silly Japanese that he didn't know, you know. The man was perfectly amazed. I've forgotten which one it was.
You're just speaking.
But anyway, then he brought quite a number of Japanese up here who worked on the campus and lived with us. Mm-hmm. And we went to the 2 o'clock train day in and day out, putting them on the train and picking them up.
Mm-hmm. Now, these were Japanese people who were coming.
Evacuated, but they were in the camp at in Arkansas. And they were trying to get them to other parts of the country,
I
you
see.
Know.
Okay.
So they all wanted to go back to California, and a good many have mm-hmm. since then.
Yeah.
But this was to have them employed mm-hmm. up here, and we had several on the campus.
Okay. So you were sort of a coordinator for finding jobs and seeing that they got there.
And Michigan and other states were trying to help find people to go out in the various parts mm-hmm. of the United States to help food production problems.
Dr. Gardner became director of the experiment station in the early 40s, didn't he? And wasn't there, maybe it was about 45?
I would
like
say
that.
43, 44, somewhere in there.
It was before, I think before we went to Brazil, I would think so.
Dr. Tukey came as his replacement as head of the department then, didn't he?
That's right.
While we were in Brazil, he came. So Vic must have left the Hurt Department mm-hmm. a year or two before. Mm-hmm. Okay, another good story.
Okay, I'll leave it on.
Oh, I don't believe
that's
so.
Here, we'll erase it.
This is two family.
We'll erase it if we don't like it.
Well. Our son was just a youngster then, and he loved the Hurt Department, and he used to ride with Mr. Brown, you know, who was a farm foreman for many years. Don't you know him? Too bad. And Bob really thought, you know, he was part of that Hurt Department. Well, there was much discussion when Vic was made director of the experiment station. They were also replacing the dean of agriculture. And Bob had heard some of the men discussing this little situation. First time he saw Mr. Gardner, he said, "How'd you like to have been dean, Mr. Gardner?" Fortunately, his father wasn't there and didn't have to hear it. "How'd you like to have been dean, Mr. Gardner?"
And there was a possibility that he might be dean rather than director? Or
both, yes.
Or both.
Well, I guess Dr. Shaw had been both, hadn't he?
Yes.
Shaw had been both, I think. I'm not. I don't remember enough about it now.
It's easy to find in the history book, but it's hard to find the anecdotes in the history book.
Well, that's don't
right.
take mine.
They strike them out.
Yeah.
They might be considered catty.
No, I don't think so. How was Dr. Tukey received here? I presume that he was
well
respected.
Depends on who you talk to.
Yes, because of his background and training and all, he was very well respected by most of the staff, I think. But there was that question of who was replacing who and who would take the information background mm-hmm. and make use of it at the jealousy of staff members mm-hmm. who didn't want to see any changes.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
And so that's always been a problem, whether they changed presidents or deans or just staff members. Where did they come from? What do they know? What have they written? Those are standard questions.
They didn't have as many committees and commissions and so forth to decide on it.
I wondered who was responsible for appointing Tukey then. I should think that Gardner would have had a say in that.
Well, they knew they had to find a replacement. Mm-hmm. And so they heard viewpoints from many sources, both favorable and unfavorable. So I suppose it was the basic background and the need for replacement that they had to decide whether to take him or not.
Well, all of you were consulted as to whether you wanted somebody in the department or somebody outside, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
I think that's the way they did it.
That was a standard question.
Everybody was asked.
Because most of the institution and the state wanted them to choose locally. Mm-hmm. And a stranger was always a foreigner. And no matter what his training or background was, if they didn't know about him, if they hadn't had him here to give talks or something.
Yeah, well, I think that's the tendency to pick someone you know.
That's true.
Now, who, do you remember who might have been the chairman?
Personal problem was coming from the West and then going to South America for 2 years and then coming back, and Gardner, I suppose, was the main one who had been out West, knew us personally in our home country, and had inspired a lot of us in trying out certain things, including spray materials, and later on when they got them in a dry form as called dust and dusting to work on that. And the problem was to find somebody whose place we could work on. And I suppose for that reason, we moved into Fenville.
That was because Traver was willing to have you use his
farm. That's right.
He was, and Orville Roth, too.
And Orville Roth.
They were interested enough in having things done in Michigan and in using their facilities to try them out. And that was hard to do in most of the state. Mm-hmm. Because they were, especially if you came from some other state, they were pretty much in doubt as to what you were trying to do and could do. And
well, lime sulfur is all anybody knew then, wasn't it?
what were they using in 1923?
Oh, it was mostly Bordeaux mixture.
Mm-hmm. And what was the quality of the fruit? Is it hard to remember?
Well,
I'm thinking particularly of insects, like codling moth and apple maggot. If we raise apples today without any spray, they're loaded with apple maggot.
That's right. Well, that's entirely new to us. I don't even recall having any problem in those early days. No. It came later.
Now, when did they start using lead arsenate then?
Well,
that must have been mid-30s.
Just about the time you bowed out, wasn't it?
But you probably weren't involved too much in the pesticide area. You were more in the pruning.
No, it was a matter of what poison was safe to use and would do the work of control. That's long ago, and the details of the whys and wherefores is pretty much.
Yeah. Well, you often hear the comment that people didn't used to use pesticides, in 1900, let's say, that there were very few pesticides used, if any. If the growers sprayed, they sprayed twice.
That's right.
Today, they're spraying 20 times or 25 times.
Are they really?
Very true.
And apples, this is. Now, why can't we go back to the two sprays and have just as good fruit?
The planes have brought the bugs in.
Well, there are some reasons suggested, but I just wondered if you remembered. Apparently, they had good apples in the 20s, even though they only put on a few sprays.
Well, the reason of that, I think, was because they picked only the good apples. And I can still see orchard owners and their workers. And their workers were usually cattlemen and crop growers, general crops, and not in horticulture at all. And but I can still see them as the pickers that they hired. They were taught to throw everyone away that didn't look perfect. And so 2/3 of the motions were throwing the apple back into the field.
But do you know, Cardi, when we first came here, we said the flavor of Michigan apples was superior to the Western apples.
Yeah.
Not the condition and the form of them, but the flavor was better. The skins weren't as thick. I don't know, but I remember we all said, all of us who lived in the West too, felt that the flavor was better.
And I think the reason for that may have been, as I think back, was that they didn't preserve and save the apples that they knew by the appearance of them. It was not the right color, the right maturity, and freedom from insects and disease. Mm-hmm. And the rest were pitched out. So I presume they saved and later propagated from the particular branches or on particular trees where they found the apple they personally liked and that buyers wanted to repeat. Mm-hmm. I can think of no other reason behind it.
Were they barreling apples then?
Yes.
Probably most of them went into barrels.
That's right. Most of them went into barrels. And I can't see.
How about dry houses? Were there dry houses here? They didn't smell
them?
No,
they were just. They packaged or stored the best ones. And they were chosen by appearance primarily. As coming from the trees they had chosen to save for their own use and to sell.
What are dry houses?
Well, dry houses, they used to peel the apples and slice them, and then put them on slabs.
I see.
And then they would heat, they had a heater, a furnace, and the fumes would go up through and the apples would dry out.
There wasn't much of that.
No, we had none of that.
There was a lot in New York State.
Very little here.
That went out about 1910, I think, something like that. But they used to dry them and then export them. There was a lot of drying and exporting. This was in New York State. Now, I don't think I've ever seen a dry house here.
No, I don't think they...
I don't remember any.
But they're scattered all around New York State.
Yeah. Well, everything started there. Except a few.
Lots of storages, but cold, what they call cold storage, but not refrigerated.
Yeah, they're common storage. Now, Peach Ridge was famous for peaches. I don't know, just, I suppose about early in the teens at least.
Yeah.
Now, were they raising peaches there when you started work?
Yes.
In the Bailey area?
That's where I got acquainted with some of the best producers up in that area, was through their peaches. Mm-hmm. And then from there on, we began introducing various things that we were working on that they needed or could use. And
do you remember when the Red Haven peach came out?
Oh, very decidedly. Yes.
And that was very well received by growers?
Oh, yes.
I suppose they were growing Albertas for the most part to begin with.
I suppose the name was the inspiration of that thing. Anything red was, whether it was an apple or a peach or what, it was to be considered.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was early.
To produce as well as to sell. And it still determines a lot of things, I guess. And red apples and red peaches and apricots and everything
else
that's coming.
It was chiefly the Schaefers, the Schaefer brothers that you worked with at Peach Ridge, and I think the son still carries on.
Mm-hmm.
He did the last I knew.
Arnold Schaefer.
Yes, Arnold Schaefer.
Mm-hmm. Because you had several extension tours up there.
Yes, we got many meetings up there because the growers from other parts of the state, particularly southern Michigan, didn't know anything about that part of Michigan.
I thought that we forgot about at the time.
Partridge was famous for developing a system of pruning grapes.
Mm-hmm.
20 plus 10, 30 plus 10.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it started.
Now, but did he work on grapes here at Michigan?
No, I believe not.
Well, yeah.
Except to...
You mean here at the college or down there?
No, here. Now, Partridge was here at East Lansing?
Yes. But he did most of his grape work.
Down around Pawpaw?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He was down there quite a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there an experiment station there? Did he stay down there or did he drive back and forth?
No, he stayed down there.
Stayed down there.
But it wasn't a real... He didn't have a building of his own, did he?
No, I don't think so.
I think just quarters where he worked.
So he was working in growers' vineyards?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he had a stove to sell. He couldn't come back up here because who'd take care of the stove?
Stove?
We met him in South Haven, at Fenville, the Duttons, and we went on a trip down there. And Partridge happened to be over there, else he came to meet you. I don't know what it was. But that night he told us, they were trying to make him come back here. They thought he had really completed his work. And they were going to make him come back. And he didn't want to. He liked it down there where he was on his own. So what would he do with that stove? And of course, after he went, we all laughed about it. The first thing in the morning, when he appeared again, it was the matter of that stove. What would he do with it?
Still on his mind. Dr. Lucas did some work. He had a project on the effect of apples on people's health.
That's right. And they used the student body and the Hort club and Hort students and so forth, what he could get a hold of.
Then he worked on cancer too. He dried currants and gooseberries and almost every fruit you had, hoping that it was going to have something to do with cancer.
His background and training were so superior to most of us.
The currants used to be mine out there at the station that he began that work, so I remember it.
He robbed you of your currants.
Nobody else wanted them.
Don't you like currant jelly?
I love it.
They're all red and white. Didn't have any black currants, I suppose.
No, they were all red.
In fact, I guess black currants were illegal to raise.
They were right down there by the railroad track.
Mm-hmm. Along with the blueberries? No, I guess not, because blueberries are another place.
I don't remember.
I changed that so out there, I can't even remember what it used
to
look like.
It's Bob Lurie's blueberries that I remember here in East Lansing. I don't remember at the farm.
Tell me about Lucas. You spoke about his superior training.
Yes, his background, book reading and general knowledge and so forth, had developed a special interest that he could analyze and try to convince some people around here to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And to work on them. So we were quite impressed, a few of us anyhow, with Dr. Lucas' book reading and background.
Mm-hmm.
And what he thought about anything we'd ask about. So
How about Miss Felbers? You had her down there?
No. Miss
Felbers? She was another German that we had.
Now, who was the first German?
Dr. Lucas.
Oh, Lucas was German.
Yes.
Do you have that famous publication that Lucas got out here toward the end of his career, where he had all the students chewing and biting and tasting these apples?
Well, I understood that Lucas died before that was published, and that Didolf was here then, and Didolf had the job of writing it up.
I think I have extra copies of it, so...
I'd like to have a copy, because I haven't seen it myself. How about Miss Barrett, who was...
Mrs. Barrett was the secretary.
Mrs. Barrett.
Mrs. Barrett.
She was Dr. Tukey's secretary.
Dr. Tukey, and she came about 2 years before he did.
Mm-hmm. Now, did she come from Geneva?
Mm-hmm.
And I've always understood that she did a lot of Tukey's administrative work, that she knew just what he wanted done, and he would
I think so. Her. She was very efficient anyway. Mm-hmm.
Is she still living?
Mm-hmm. In Florida. She went to Florida.
Did you hear her while I'm down there?
Well, I'll tell you where you can find, if the gardeners don't know. Oh dear, am I going to forget that man's name. He lives up here on Forest, and he sees her. And she lived across the street from him when they lived here. And he sees her down there.